from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about the new Artistry residential building downtown that includes a gallery space.
I'll meet Barbara Magnus Hopkins, who's an artist who's also blind.
And I'll talk with the star of the play Defending the Caveman, which is opening at Tots for an extended run. Plus, it'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Artistry is the new redevelopment of the former Bank One Operations Center at 451 East Market Street. It's an unusual project for Millhouse Development. The housing developer sought help from marketing and experience design firm Q7 Associates, which recommended many artistic elements, including a soaring art gallery space in the mixed-use complex. Sharon Gamble learned more from Q7's G. Key Rowe, as well as Walter Kanavi, whose show inaugurated the gallery space and has been extended.
So welcome, not just to the Art of the Matter, but to a cool new partnership. GK, I want to start with you. So this was a project that was scheduled to open, and you kind of put the brakes on with your project partners. Is that a fair assessment? For a good reason.
Yeah, I guess that's probably natural for how we work with any client. So this wasn't necessarily new, but Millhouse Development, who was responsible for the Artistry project, came to us with the need for experience-based marketing and design.
Before you move on, define that for us.
Yeah, and we pay attention to every touch point through the consumers, what we call their journey. So that would be from the time they become aware of what's happening with the product or project, all the way through to the how they use it and how they continue to enjoy it. So it is a seven-step process.
So it's not just from first awareness to purchasing.
It goes beyond that, exactly. It actually stems from awareness all the way through to advocacy. Mm-hmm. So our hope is that people enjoy the product or the process enough where they're talking about it in a very positive light.
Mm-hmm.
That's our company's main goal with any piece of project or development that we work on. So we have a different approach. In most marketing firms, as we are all defined as being different.
Sure.
That's where we are different in our own way. We partnered very well with Millhouse because they were energized and looking and excited about the same type of, we use the same type of language. We have the same concerns with our end users. They wanted to bring something to the city beyond just a new revitalized space, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
It meant a lot to them to assess in great detail how people will enjoy their project for years to come.
So tell us a little bit about the space.
Yeah. It is a 258 apartment unit. They have 9-foot to 14-feet ceilings. It is urban in its stylization. It certainly fits into the community. It also embraces the art and skill of the Cole Noble District, both in its architecture and also in its interior design.
Its previous life was as?
Yeah, its previous life was as the old Bank One Operations Center.
Mm-hmm.
So as most people know that have lived in the downtown area, we've seen that property sit in some disarray states for quite some time. So a lot of people were looking in that direction, wanting to know you know, what's going to happen. So we knew going into this that we were under the microscope. People were going to have an opinion about what this space needed to be, should be. We were going to be judged.
Not least because there's an awful lot of traffic passing
sure.
by there all yeah. the time.
Yeah, so we had a lot of opinions in the mix, which brought us to the naming of the property, which was one of the pieces that Millhouse had asked us to pitch towards them.
So how fleshed out was the idea of incorporating visual art when Millhouse came to you? Did they say, we think this should be part of the vision for this property, can you help us? Or did you say, you and your creative partners say, hey, have you thought about?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it went. They gave us quite a bit of free rein. Of course, they assessed and judged on their end what decisions needed to be made for the best respect for the property. But politely enough, they allowed us to do our due diligence on creativity. And so that was part of our concepting. And we knew that we had a thriving art community in the downtown area. We certainly wanted to pay respect to the Cole Noble District and its craft and skill. And we had a lot of thriving art pieces surrounding that. And so we ultimately landed on the name Artistry.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't initially think that we were going to put an art gallery space in this, even at the beginning stages of naming it Artistry.
Mm-hmm.
But as the process unfolded, it made sense to make a commitment. One of the other objectives for this project was to embrace the community. And so that's where we faceted with artists within the community, and Millhouse stepped up and purchased artwork for the space from local artists. So all the artists that are in the space are local to Indiana.
Buy local. We appreciate that.
Yes.
Walter, as an artist who's been in Indianapolis a good deal of time now, do you remember your first response when you saw this space, both the art gallery space and the building in general?
Oh, I mean, the building's wonderful. I mean, it's just really gorgeous design and feels very fresh, clean lines. So it's very it feels very accessible.
Mm-hmm.
What intrigued me about the gallery space that I thought was just brilliant is the fact that it actually the artwork shows by the windows to the outside. So what I really like a lot is for artwork to be fairly democratic and accessible
mm-hmm.
to the general public, and I've always been very big on that. So the idea of for instance, the Arts Council is doing some billboards with artists' work that
right.
they're just wonderful.
I saw one going
I'm
up.
I'm so excited
yeah.
for these artists as well who got the gig. I mean, and they're just thrilled. But this, I feel like, doesn't take it a step further, but I love the fact that I can actually exhibit my fine art exactly. I mean, it's physically there, yet it's accessible to people outside in the public as they drive or walk by. It's a really unique situation and something that I really embrace.
When you were thinking about the show that's up and that's mm-hmm. been extended there, did you create new pieces or did you select from pieces you already had and or some mm-hmm. combination thereof?
Mm-hmm.
And how did the fact that you had all that natural light play into mm-hmm. what you chose mm-hmm. to install?
The work actually was in the process, so some of it was done, some of it wasn't. So it's terribly current work. I mean, it would be just as if I did a gallery show at any other gallery.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely current for my work, and the narrative that's going on and the cohesion between the pieces in that sense is certainly there. You talk about the light. I think the one thing that I love about it is that natural light. My studio, I'm fortunate enough to have a lot of natural light. And secondly, I would say one of my forte is color.
Mm-hmm.
So to really get that saturated color across, you do need to have correct lighting, and daylight seems to be the best. What's intriguing, though, is obviously the winter light is different than spring light
right.
or summer light. and light is very different here than it is in Europe. And I'm intrigued with that as well. And, of course, color depends on light.
Well, I'm seeing some sort of show that evolves as the light changes through the seasons, or maybe a solstice equinox kind of co-installation project in the future.
That's interesting you put it that way, because part of my credo with my work is has to do with mythology and fairy tale and things like that. So you're talking about the changes with that would be very appropriate.
Yeah, sounds like a good vocabulary fit. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, GK, how now that this is kind of up and running, what is your continuing role with Artistry?
We are continuing to work with them to facilitate just the art component of things. It's a new concept for a developer to embrace, to even want to subject themselves to the risk of caring for artwork. They certainly are in more of a position to want to care for a structural facility, which they do. But we've added another layer to that and asked them and their management team to embrace a new concept here, which involves them looking beyond what their normal scope would be. They have to take into account the artwork, their collection, which they've purchased. One of Walter's pieces is part of the permanent collection as well as his exhibited
work.
So there are a lot of factors involved in caring for their current collection when it's open to a public space, which it is. So we'll continue to help them manage that. Eventually they will take care of that process on their own once they have landed more in the process of being able to flush out some of the construction pieces that are currently going on.
Sure. One thing, of course, that immediately springs to mind is there's an insurance component. What are some of the other accommodations that a developer wouldn't normally think about?
Insurance is certainly one of them. Safety of the artwork, safety of the people, to make sure that you don't brush up against something, that you're not going to have glass in an area where there's concrete, where you're moving things in and out, that you're not going to hurt the artwork or cause harm to somebody else. You need to make sure that the facility is done in a way that you can take work down and replace work easily if it's a rotated area. So that takes additional manpower and cost, and then lighting, of course,
sure,
and how that gets positioned. And then working with the interior design team and having a synergistic relationship with them to be able to select the artwork and then have them have their vision as well for the interior space.
Sure.
So those are just some of the things that are added components, which I'm glad they embrace. I would like to also comment that Walter's work that's in the exhibiting area, that's in the glass partition piece, is scale was another appealing part. And he works very large or has very large works of art. So they're very visible from Market Street as you pass by.
Sure.
So that was another aspect of his work that was nice to have in the opening exhibit.
Right, right. Yeah. Are there any mediums, restrictions? I'm picturing mostly painting and sculpture. Might there be other?
Yeah, we tried to keep, as a matter of fact, we did a call to artists. We worked with the Arts Council, and they were very helpful to help push out information. We received a large response from Indiana artists, and we tried to keep the genre and the medium mix. So while we found it was a very difficult process, actually, we received a lot of really good work, and it was very difficult to edit down the process. But it was done mostly through scale and color choice and things like that helped in the process. But yes, we have photography, two-dimensional painting, we have mixed media, and some sculptural work as well. We're limited to not having video pieces just because of the installation process.
Sure.
We just weren't prepared for that.
Sure. But it could still be phased in the future. Who knows?
Sure.
Walter, your favorite piece of your own in the current show? I know all your children are beautiful.
Well,
but...
that's absolutely correct. And after seeing both my daughters over Christmas break, well, that rings pretty accurate. I have to agree with GK that the scale was a factor on these pieces, and I do have one piece in there that I believe is 6 by 8 or 9 feet.
Wow.
And that piece, because of the graphic nature of it also, it has some very large elements, but there's a simplicity about it. And I think it would be that piece. I think they can read it from the street very, very well. Mm-hmm. And the message is very clear. And so I would have to say that the large piece that's in there.
Cool. And of course, folks can stop in on First Friday in early February. But otherwise, hours, when can people come in to see the
art? They're welcome to stop by. The leasing office is open from, I believe, 9 to 5. Their mm-hmm. hours are on their website.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly open to the public to come in and enjoy and take a look at the collection.
Sharon Gamble with G. Key Rowe of marketing and experience design firm Q7 and Walter Kanabe, whose show at the gallery at Artistry has been extended. Artistry is at 451 East Market Street. It's the adaptive reuse of the former Bank One Operations Center. In addition to the art gallery, the space has apartments and commercial space for rent, a rooftop pool, bocce court, vegetable garden, and other unusual amenities. Learn more about the project at artistryindy.com. That's artistryindy.com. And 2014, Walter Kanabe Studios is celebrating its 30th anniversary. You can see Walter's work at walterkanabe.com. That's Walter, and then the last name is K-N-A-B-E. So it's walterkanabe.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Artist Barbara Magnus Hopkins is known for her watercolors of Indiana landscapes, as well as her paintings of flowers and barns. She currently is involved with the Indiana State Library's Talking Book and Braille Library campaign because she is also blind. Travis DiNicola spoke with her about her work.
Barbara, welcome to Art of the Matter. It's great to have you in our studio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've been looking forward to this because I've certainly got a lot of questions for you. But the one that I want to start with is, help me understand the severity of your visual impairment. I mean, and how long has this been a part of your life?
I am going blind from macular degeneration mm-hmm. and diabetic neuropathy. I have severe diabetes. I have been a research patient for many years for Eli Lilly. And as I get older, my sight is going. And so I thought I would like to learn how to live in a darker world.
Mm-hmm.
And I attended BOSMA School for the Visually Impaired and the Blind. And this is for adults.
Mm-hmm. Now, but had you been a painter before that, correct?
Always.
Always had been a painter, had gone to Heron.
Yes. From 6 years old, I did my first won my first blue ribbon
mm-hmm.
when I was in Irvington, and they marked off the windows
mm-hmm.
and that was it. And then my art teacher helped and encouraged me.
So you've been a painter all your life, but how long has it been since you've been dealing with your eyesight going away now?
Probably now about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I still, sometimes I'm not very nice about it,
mm-hmm.
and I don't like it, because for an artist to lose your sight is kind of severe, but I decided.
It's going to be very frightening.
Yes, it is. And not to be in control of what you do,
mm-hmm.
and I'm used to doing, I do an awful lot of home portraits.
Mm-hmm.
And
portraits of people's houses.
Yes.
And which certainly involve quite a lot of detail.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And some of them, the last batch I did, I could only have 2 inches from the top of the roof to the foundation. And that's kind of bad when you want bricks and glass and stained glass in the windows and all of that, you know. So it was a challenge. And I used a big magnifying glass that clamps onto the table in the kitchen. And then I have small magnifying glasses.
Do you primarily work from photographs now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. And so photographs of the house or of the
whatever I am looking to paint.
Sure.
Right.
And then you mentioned these very big magnifiers that are sort of on these arms, like almost like a high intensity lamp type of thing that you can move around and use.
Right. It does. It has 2 lights underneath it, and that lights up the thing. And I was first introduced to it by Crossroads. Crossroads has a lot of equipment to help handicapped people, and they loan it to them. And so they had loaned it to me, and then I eventually bought one from Amazon.
And you also mentioned attending Bosma School for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Obviously, I mean, you picked up a lot of techniques there as far as how to cope.
Yes. By the time you finish school there, which is normally like 5 to 6 months, they teach you how to clean. They have rooms that they're set up and you can go in and clean them. And they teach you how to cook. They show you how to measure things by even putting your finger at the edge of like a coffee cup. And so that you will know when you get to the top. And it's hard when you're pouring white milk into a white cup.
Sure.
Because you can't see what begins and what ends, you know. And they teach you, they take you downtown and they walk you around and they show you how to use a cane, which I do. And I even, wherever it is, I even worked on it. This is not
real. Yeah, you decorated your cane a bit.
It's bejeweled. Yes, yes, yes. And then also I have been blessed. I wasn't too thrilled. A lady came to me and she said, "Barbara, I have these terrible shoes. They're the corrective shoes and I will not wear them. You've got to paint them." Hmm. And I said, "Paint them? I paint paintings, not shoes."
Mm-hmm.
So
I see you brought them with you.
I brought a couple.
Well, they're lovely, and they're with beautiful flowers and also bejeweled and
yeah.
And just some great shoes. I want to ask you about something that you brought something very special along to the studio, and that would be a box of paints. And you know, I must say when I first saw the box of paints, I want to say, well, you know, this is radio. We can't see this at all. But then you opened one up for me and I got to smell your orange paint and it smells like citrus. And then I opened up the vanilla and it smells like almonds. So you are using paints now that you're making, you're adding scent to.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot yet because I haven't lost it completely.
Mm-hmm.
But. It's fun mixing it up and, you know, and this was extract, which would damage the paint. And that's, acrylic paint.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that's what I'm going to use. And,
I just opened up the red and it's got a cherry smell.
Yes. Is it a lemon and
yeah.
Peppermint? If you got the blue, I put peppermint.
Yes. I just opened up the blue as well. So. You know, I must say, I can't imagine, Barbara, how frustrating it had to be for you when you first realized you were going blind and you are going blind as an artist. But, I mean, you certainly have found some very clever and creative and fascinating ways to cope with this. But I'm sure it's got to be very difficult. It's changed your art, I have no doubt.
My art has gotten a lot brighter.
Yeah.
Monet is one of my mentors.
Mm-hmm.
And when Monet first started painting, his water lilies were white. When he died, his water lilies were purple and deep red.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had macular degeneration. And then he also took his paintbrushes and taped them to his hand because he had such bad arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taped like this, and that's the way he worked.
To be able to hold the brush.
Right.
You were showing me a piece before we went on the air. It's a piece of monument circle of,
yes,
of the monument, and it's somewhat hazy. And you said that it wasn't because of your eyesight. That's how you chose to paint it, though, right?
I wanted the emphasis to be on the monument itself,
mm-hmm,
and then these were just sort of
the buildings around it are sort of more
right
hazy.
And I'm starting to do more of downtown Indianapolis. Sometimes I don't really get a chance to do paintings on my own,
mm-hmm,
that they are for someone else or something, you know, like that, or for a contest or something. And so I'm going to finish doing them. I have a friend that's a photographer, and he's taking and shooting them for me around town.
Now, Barbara, your work is often shown at the Art Bank, is that correct?
Yes, I have a room. There are 30 artists,
yeah,
at the Art Bank, and I have half a room, and I've been there, I think, probably about 3.5 years now.
And that's a great space, just on Mass Avenue, just a little bit east of college, on
right
sort of that east end. And they, of course, do regular First Friday openings as well as other events.
Right, mm-hmm, right, right. And it's good for exposure. I also have ads in some publications for my homes,
mm-hmm,
and Your Home as Art is, mm-hmm, what I call it.
Okay.
And that's, you know, what I think it is. But also then, I like doing public art. I have done that. And recently, last year, I did a charity event at Lafayette Art Museum,
mm-hmm,
where you decorated a chair and then they auctioned it off. Well, it wasn't going so well, so I decided to buy it back.
Uh-huh.
So I did. And my husband on the way home thought that this is rather unusual, Barbara. He said, you keep doing these and bringing them back home. And I had done a dog for the veterinary school at Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
And I bid on it till somebody outbid me at $1,000. But that I said, after all, that was my dog. I wanted him back. So,
can you tell me a little bit about the... We got connected through through a mutual friend of ours, and I know you've been doing a little bit of work with the Indiana State Library, their Talking Book and Braille Library campaign.
Right.
Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, well, the Talking Book is mm-hmm, so good. It's one of the things that I missed more than anything else was reading.
Sure, of course.
And reading like 2 or 3 books at a time, and then... But so I found out through Bosma about the library's Talking Books,
mm-hmm,
and they send you a catalog, and you pick out the books you want, and you send it back in, and then they send you the books,
mm-hmm,
and you send some books back, and you get more books, and you send books back, and you get more books, and it's really a fabulous program, and I was their feature artist at their symposium this year, and also with another artist. And mm-hmm, then last year I was the only one there was an artist that was there.
Yeah, well, there aren't many artists that are blind.
I know.
Yes.
I know.
But you are making it work.
I will.
And you'll then continue to do so. What's next for you?
Just keep on. Just keep on keeping on, you know. Next time I'll have more colors in there with herbs and spices in them. And that's what will happen. If I have to paint that way, I will.
Well, what I'm wondering is if you start using these scented paints, will once the paint dries, will it still have...
I wonder.
We'll have to find out.
Yes, I know. That'll be the next session.
Well, what could be really neat is if you start painting, because I know you also paint flowers and things, and if you can work the scent of the flower or whatever it may
be
into the paint.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
That would be pretty cool.
I mean, like...
You've got a lovely purse there that you brought with you that also I'm painted with flowers and bejeweled, and I could just imagine that.
There's no end to it, you know. The dog even runs when I get out the paints.
Barbara, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Matter today. It's a real inspiration to meet you.
Thank you.
Travesty Nicola with artist Barbara Magnus Hopkins. Her work can be seen at the Art Bank on Mass Ave, just a stone's throw beyond college. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I went recently into a favorite retail store,
mm-hmm.
and the first thing you see once you enter the door and look slightly to the left or to the right, depending on whether you're at the one at Glendale or, in my case, Nora.
Okay.
Giant display of swimsuits. Eeps!
Oh, my God. Is it that time already?
Well, it's time for all those people who have a chance to get away someplace warm.
Mm.
We're not doing that, though, but we'll offer you some bright and sunny spots in our calendar we call.
What do we do? Okay, Sherry, this is kind of fun because I actually have an art event you can wear your swimsuit to.
Really?
You
awesome.
Ready?
I am so ready.
I'm not making this up. So the title of the show is The Empire Never Ended, and it's inspired by Philip K. Dick's book, Valis. And this is taking place at iMocha down in Fountain Square. Philip K. Dick is the science fiction
yes.
writer, you know, Total Recall and a whole bunch of other great things. Great science fiction writer. Well, so you know, he also experienced a lot of different hallucinations, and which is sort of
I'm
part
waiting
of where,
for the swimsuit.
And that's where part of the book Valis comes from.
Oh,
and so
it.
This exhibit that is it's art inspired by the book Valis. So artist Prince Rama, Mark Bilge, and Sergey Onin, and it's opening up on actually not opening up until the beginning of February on the 27th. I'm sorry, on the 7th. The 7th of February, and then it's going to run through April. But this is the point. You ready, Sharon?
I am.
So as part of this, and there's a lot of different installations and constructions and all dealing with sort of kitsch and pop culture and all the stuff that's part of connecting back to Dallas. But there's also going to be a Royal Spa hot tub as part of the exhibit in the gallery.
I love
because
it.
There is a connection back to the book Valis on this. And so museum members are advised to bring a swimsuit if they desire so that they have the option of changing out of their clothes into provided borrowed robes so that they may be able to fully partake in the various interactive parts of the exhibit, namely the use of the Royal Spa hot tub, which is also a sponsor of the show. So, if you are not...
We get to deal with the most creative people in the universe, you know?
Shantae Marsh, who runs iMocha, this one's brilliant. So if you, you know, perhaps were missing out on a little, you know, flight down to Florida to get away and experience some warm weather, just go down to iMocha in February and bring your swimsuit.
But if you wear it, wear a few layers over
yeah,
the
you
top,
might want to do that,
because
yeah.
we don't want you freezing on the way.
Well, what do you got, Sharon?
I'm desperately trying to find a segue between that and my next item, but I can't. So we'll just say, and now for something completely different, as they used to on Monty Python. Bach, Bratz, and Byron. this is taking place. This Sunday, January 26th at 4 o'clock at Pilgrim Lutheran Church, which is at 3650 West 106th Street in Carmel, so just a stone's throw mm-hmm, into Carmel. Mm-hmm. Pilgrim Lutheran Church in Carmel, this Sunday, 4 o'clock. The Bach, self-explanatory. The Bratz, also self-explanatory. It's a concert with a bratwurst dinner following. But the Byron, no, not Lord Byron. It is a very talented violinist, Byron Plexico, who also happens to be the Anderson Symphony's concertmaster. He's going to perform two sonatas for violin by Bach with accompaniment by Sarah Williams on the organ. Also, Sarah Williams, who happens to be Pilgrim's organist, will present a Bach prelude and fugue. Perfectly appropriate for children, and kids under 12 are admitted for free. Everybody else, $10. And remember, that includes a bratwurst dinner. So there's a fun way to warm up.
I love
winter.
Bratwurst.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Great. Oh, very fun. Hey, it's not too early to start thinking about Valentine's Day, Sharon. Maybe I'm just in a romantic mood,
sweet?
But I am thinking about it. And here is a great thing to do with your sweetie. There is a concert called Agape, which is a celebration of love. And it's a cabaret performance featuring the incredibly talented Gail Payne. Maybe you saw her with her Amour show last year at the Fringe. Great cabaret singer. She's going to be with David Duncan on piano and Sandy Williams on guitar. And it's taking place at the Christian Theological Seminary. It's actually a fundraiser for them, which is pretty cool. And it is taking place on Friday, February 14th for Valentine's Day, 8 p.m. concert, 9 p.m. dessert reception. You can get more information at Christian Theological Seminary or on thegoodslife.com, which is Gail's website. But it should be a very, very romantic evening and a cool event as a fundraiser as well.
Good cause. That's right. Hey, so you love your kids, so I have something a little before Valentine's Day you can take them to. It's Hot Jazz for Cool Kids at Central Library. On Sunday, February 9th, they can hear, you can hear, because you're going to go with them, of course, you can hear Pavel and Direct Contact. Latin jazz, Latin American jazz, Afro-Latin jazz, all of these descriptions fit.
Sure, and that is all the time we have, so we will be back next week with some more warm things to do on that calendar we call.
What will we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Rob Becker's Defending the Caveman has been wildly successful around the world for its hilarious take on how men and women react very differently to life. Actor Kevin Burke has performed the one-man show more than 4,000 times, including a long run in Las Vegas, and he's bringing the show to Indianapolis at Theater on the Square beginning this week.
Before we talk about Defending the Caveman, I want you to tell us how you got involved in performing in the first place.
I was in high school, and I was a band geek. I grew up in Munster, Indiana, which is up in the northwest corner of the state, and I was in marching band.
What'd you play?
Drummer.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you know, that means trouble. Lock up your daughters. And I started working out as a musician. I got my card in the musicians union up there, and I was everybody's substitute drummer because I was in high school. And then a teacher came up to me and said, you know, we think you would be good in a play. Why don't you try out for this play? And I went, all right. And I did. And from that moment on, I was hooked.
Was it a comedy?
No, it was Dracula.
Really?
Yeah.
Who did you play?
I played Jonathan Harker, who is Mina's fiance, and she is the one that Dracula has loved throughout the centuries.
Right. Yeah. But you were kind of the romantic lead.
I was the romantic lead, yes. Yes, I was. If you can believe that, so look at me now.
It's radio, so I have to tell you, dear listeners, he's a very handsome man.
Well, now. Let's turn these lights down a little lower.
And a very funny one. You'll discover that over the next few minutes. So what did you like about being in that play?
It was a chance to go outside of myself and to become someone who I wasn't.
Huh.
And I have to be honest with you, at that point, doing it in high school and then going on to the drama department at Indiana University, I found myself in an environment where I was one of the few straight guys surrounded by women.
Fringe benefits of the career. I know you're not joking.
I'm not kidding. I'm not going to lie to you. It was awesome. You know, in your ballet class, if you're the only straight guy in your ballet class, holy cow.
Did you keep up your musical side career, or did that kind of take backseat after?
I played out professionally from the time I was 16 until I was about 22. I settled into a band that was a 12-piece rhythm and blues show band.
Oh.
Yeah, called the Upper U.S. Show Band. Yeah, and our motto was, if you don't like our music, Upper U.S.
12-piece, that's really interesting.
Full horn section, everything, yeah.
Wow.
And we played in an illegal nightclub in Hammond, Indiana.
Illegal because minors were allowed?
No, illegal because it was not intended to be a nightclub and had zero licensing.
Oh, I'm guessing they're not still in business. So
absolutely.
Okay.
In fact, the Chicago Tribune just did a whole article about them.
Really? What's it Should we say what it's called?
Sure, fine. The nightclub itself doesn't have a name, but go into the Chicago Tribune search box and enter upper U.S. show band.
Got it.
And it'll come up. The owner of the band, the guy who fronts the band, is a fellow named Don Deal. And he owns a body shop up in Hammond. And the body shop used to be a tombstone factory back in the 20s. And it's this big, huge barrel vault of a building. And four or five times a year, he cleans out all the cars, paints the floor. There's a stage built in there, he turns it into a nightclub that looks like anything you would see anyplace else. It's sort of like a modern speakeasy.
So it's like Brigadoon. It appears occasionally.
Yes,
out of the mist.
Oh, no, here's the best part. It's on Highland Street, so it comes out of the Highland mist.
Oh, no, I love it.
Yeah.
What a treat.
Oh, it's awesome. We packed the place out, about 300 people. And the guys who play in the band tend to this is fun. Okay, I got to tell you the story. For the last 6 years, I've been doing Defending the Caveman out in Las Vegas.
Indeed you have.
And I was also doing my own show, my own stand-up comedy show, in another hotel called The Fitz. And one of the trumpet players and I were talking one day, and he said, Don said that, he said, I'll probably never get back to Vegas again, but if I ever did, this is the band I would want to take. Because this is the best band right now that I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to the trumpet player, why don't you guys come out and play for a weekend as part of my show? You know, instead of it being an hour-long show, we'll make it a three-hour show. And, you know, people can come and go as they want. And
how fun is that?
And so they did.
And everybody was available?
Yeah. They made themselves available.
Yeah.
Sure. It was great. It was a chance. The band came out. A bunch of the band's fans came out.
Sure.
And they kicked butt. Local Las Vegas people came to see the show the first night. The next night, all those people came back and brought all their friends.
Whoa. And you reprised your role on drums, I
hope. Did not.
You did not?
No. I played some baritone sax, and that was it.
Wow.
And the people who came to see the show, the locals, were saying, where can we see you again? Where can we see you again? And the people in the band were, you can't. Why not? Well, we're from Chicago. Well, where do you play in Chicago? We'll come there. You can't. Why not? It's an illegal nightclub.
That only made it that more desirable,
I'm sure.
Yeah,
it was great.
What fun. So you live in Zionsville. You're based here.
Yes, absolutely.
But you've been an entertainer of various kinds. You've toured all over the place.
I've done Defending the Caveman everywhere from Hawaii to Paris, France.
And you're upwards of like 4,000
performances. The Guinness Book of Records has Hal Holbrook in Mark Twain Tonight.
Mm-hmm.
As being the official record holder at something like 2,500 performances. If I can go back and document, I've got him crushed.
You sure do.
Yeah. But I have a Guinness record of my own.
Which is?
And I set this in Las Vegas last year, and it is most theatrical performances in 50 days. The previous record was 51 performances. I beat that with 60.
So there were a couple of days you were doing two shows a day.
Yes, and in that 7 week period, I only took 2 days off.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you stayed on your feet. Didn't get sick. Didn't get run down.
No. I did. Sure, I did. But I powered on through it.
Yeah. So Defending the Caveman is a fairly famous brand. Even people who haven't seen it kind of know what it is.
Yes.
But there's an elite group. There's only a handful of sanctioned performers who've done this show, right?
Yeah, Rob Becker was looking for someone to replace himself in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just done a one-man show here in town at the Phoenix Theater about being a dad, being a former Ringling Brothers circus clown, being the great-grandson of a fraudulent spiritualist medium, and how all of this is the parental legacy I will pass down to my children. And then at the end of the show, my then 2.5-year-old daughter, McKenna, came out with her clown nose on, and we did circus tricks together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, comics, stand-up comics that were friends of mine and friends of Rob's, knew that he was looking for a replacement, and they knew that I had just done this family-friendly, family-oriented show.
Sure.
And they suggested that the two of us hook up, and we did, and there you go. So right now, there are 5 or 6 guys in the U.S. who work for the company who do the show.
Mm-hmm.
But The show is now in 40 different countries, 35 different languages. We just opened in China. Stunned silence.
I'm just thinking about the number of languages and the number of cultures you've just defined.
Here's the genius of my Dark Lords and Masters who own Defending the Caveman. Whenever the show goes into a new country, they hire a director from that country. That country then takes the script and keeps the spine of the script and the action.
Oh.
But then sort of molds it into something that reflects that culture.
Got it.
Yeah. It's brilliant.
So
it's brilliant.
If there are certain tasks that are completely out of our knowledge base that are performed by Korean husbands and wives.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. For example,
that's plugged in.
Yeah. In the German version of the show, just background. Caveman is a show that explains men to women and explains women to men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that neither side's right, neither side's wrong. We're just different in the way we communicate. For example,
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, right.
I couldn't resist. Sorry.
If a woman says "I'll call you," she means when she gets home. If a man says "I'll call you," he means before he dies. And we explain why that is. So, in the German version, the man has been thrown out of his apartment by his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
All of his stuff, everything he owns is out there on the street. And she's told him to get out until he somehow figures out how to redeem himself.
Okay.
In her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the USA, if a man's stuff is out on the sidewalk and he's out there with it and the door's locked, the next step is divorce.
Right.
Usually. It's not.
Redemption.
It's not, yeah, no, right, yeah. So big cultural differences. And he does get redeemed in Germany, and he and all his stuff are invited back.
Aw, yay.
Yeah.
I love a happy ending.
Oh, yeah.
So the show kind of looks through different filters, mm-hmm. psychology, history, mm-hmm. anthropology, mythology, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely. There are Joseph Campbellian myths in this show. It's very much the hero's journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the character starts with this horrible problem, which is that he was at a party with some women friends, and they matter-of-factly said, "Men are all," and then referred to a body part
mm-hmm.
that's not complimentary.
Mm-hmm.
Can we say that on NPR?
We can say that much here.
Okay, good. there you go. Fine. And he's thinking, well, I'm not that. And he's thinking about it when he has a vision. The caveman visits him. And shows him that throughout the course of history, men and women have been like two different cultures. And he sends him on this journey of exploration as he steals his bowling trophy on the way out. And what it boils down to is during prehistoric times, we had different skill sets to ensure survival. Men were hunters, women were gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
And those have affected the way our brains have evolved.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a hunter, you have to narrow your focus. You have to see the prey. Off in the distance, very quiet, very
mm-hmm.
silent. Too much talking, you're going to scare mm-hmm. your game away. Whereas women, out gathering nuts and berries and foods, had to keep up a constant stream of chatter to make sure that neither they nor any of the children had gotten picked off by predators.
Mm-hmm.
And remember back then, small children especially had to be with a mother because that was the only way a toddler could get fed.
Right.
So, today, we see this in the fact that they've done studies that show that women, on average, will speak 7,000 words in a day. Men, 2,000. And you see it when we text message. A woman will text her guy and say, "Honey, we really need a night out, so let's have a nice, long, romantic dinner. And then, oh, let's go see Defending the Caveman at Theater on the Square. I think we can probably get tickets at tots.org. What do you say?"
And her sweetie says, cool.
K. No,
K. Just K.
That's it. Yeah, just the letter K.
But it doesn't mean that he is not appreciative of all that thought.
No, absolutely. But and when you see where you see this cause conflict is that a guy will be sitting in his living room, focused, locked in on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
He's hunting,
mm-hmm.
right? His wife will come into the room, start talking to him, and he doesn't hear a word she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
She thinks he's ignoring her when he's not. He's really just locked in and focused. But then she gets angry and she will wrench him out of that focus. And now he's angry because he's been wrenched out of the focus. And nobody knows why it's happening.
Hmm.
So if you can understand these differences and laugh at them, they are far less overwhelming.
So, especially after more than 4,000 performances, did you get this, the psychology certificate to hang on the wall?
Ha! No. But in Las Vegas, we are what's the word I'm looking for? We are officially approved by the Nevada Association of Marriage and Family Therapists.
Love it.
Yeah, the association has always been big supporters of the show wherever we have gone.
Sure.
And of course, we are reaching out to them here in Indiana as
mm-hmm.
well.
How do you keep your performance fresh?
That big honking paycheck at the end of the week is a powerful motivator. It's a one-man show.
Yeah.
The other actor in the show is the audience.
Right.
Even though they don't have lines, the way they react to things, the way things strike them, then gives me something to play off of. And so, literally, I have a new acting partner every single night. So I have to be dialed in and present.
You can't phone
in that
in.
Moment. No. No, 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 no.
Because the chemistry is a little different every night.
Every
right?
night, sure. It's like going on a first date every night. Almost, you know, it's a whole different person that I have to relate to.
Okay.
And okay. And that's the other thing. We find that those tendencies are there in a couple, but they might be reversed.
I love it.
Yeah. The biggest motivator is that every night people walk out of the show arm in arm. You know, I see them nudging each other. Oh, you do that. Boy, that's you. There you are. And they walk out of there with their arms around each other. And one night, this was not long ago, I was doing the show in Denver. At the very end of the show, a woman yelled out, you know, I just fell in love with my husband all over again.
Oh, my gosh.
I know, right? So, you know, I'm probably the only show that's out there selling true love and monogamy and making it stick.
Sharon Gamble with award-winning actor and Zionsville resident Kevin Burke. See Kevin in Rob Becker's Defending the Caveman, which opens this week for an indefinite run at Theater on the Square. You can learn more at tots.org. That's TOTS.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m., Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of the annual Meet the Artist exhibit at the library.
I'll find out about a new initiative at Keep Indianapolis Beautiful.
And then I'll get the backstage pass for the Vonnegut play at the IRT. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.